Hi, good evening. Welcome to another edition of Little Atoms with me, Neil Denny, and with Padre Greedy. Little Atoms is a live show about ideas. Each show features a guest from the worlds of science, journalism, politics, academia, human rights, or the arts in conversation. If the show has a dominant and recurring theme, then it's normally something to do with the Enlightenment, by which we mean such things as freedom of expression, free inquiry, scepticism, and the scientific method, one of the things that we'll probably be talking about quite a lot tonight. We also end up often talking about things that are the opposite of these things, such as superstition, religious fundamentalism, totalitarianism and conspiracy theory. Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. And I'm going to hand over to Padre to introduce tonight's guest. A very welcome return to the show, actually, for Simon Singh.
Thank you, Neil. Simon Singh is an author, journalist and TV producer specialising in science and mathematics. Simon studied physics at Imperial College London before completing a PhD in particle physics at Cambridge University and at CERN, Geneva. In 1990, he joined the BBC's Science and Futures Department, where he was a producer and director working on programmes such as Tomorrow's World and Horizon. Simon has previously written two best-selling books, Fermat's Last Theorem and The Code Book, for which he subsequently produced and presented television adaptations for Channel 4, and then another bestseller, Big Bang, the Most Important Scientific Discovery of All Time and Why You Need to Know About It. Simon's latest book, co-authored with Edvard Ernst, is Trick or Treatment, Alternative Medicine on Trial. Now, Simon, when we originally booked for you for the show, we just hoped to talk about the book, but obviously some of our listeners will know you've had a rather busy week. So perhaps for the listeners who don't know, maybe we can explain what's happened.
Yeah, a busy and somewhat stressful week, to say the least. So there's not much I can say, but let me say what I can at least. And it's actually a great chance to be able to talk about this for the first time since yesterday's hearing at the High Court. It kicked off a year ago. I wrote an article for The Guardian about the British Chiropractic Association, the BCA, and what chiropractic can and can't do. And as a result of that, the BCA sued me for libel. And yesterday we had a preliminary hearing at the High Court in front of Justice Eady. And the point of that was to make some rulings, mainly on things like meaning. What was the meaning of my article? And therefore, what will I have to defend later on? And the problem was that Justice Eady gave a meaning to the article, which is going to be very, very hard to defend later on, and one that I and my legal team profoundly disagree with. So we're going to appeal. It only happened yesterday. I'm going to need the weekend to think about it. But that's certainly one possibility. And the reason for that, I think, is that it's not a meaning that I think is carried by the article. So we want to try and have that changed. If the ruling stands, I think it makes it difficult for a lot of other journalists that meanings of articles can be interpreted in this way and therefore make them more open to libel claims. And although this affects journalism more generally, my particular interest is science and medicine. And again, it affects people that want to write about all those kind of issues. So, I'll issue a press release soon. I'll issue a statement soon, which will really go into this in more detail. If people do want to find out more, there's been tons of fantastic blogging on the internet. If you Google Singh libel BCA, you'll find it very quickly. Jack of Kent is a fantastic blogger, very legally informed, knows a lot about the case. His blogs are very very much worth reading. And there's a Facebook group. If people want to join and show their support, that'd be fantastic. It's also a really good way of finding out where things are going. The people on that group post regularly as to what's happening and what the latest developments are. And finally, I'm in very good spirits. A lot of people are ringing up and just checking. I haven't descended into gloom, but absolutely not. And as I say, next week we'll make a decision as to what we're going to do next.
Mm. So as you say, it's difficult at the moment to talk about specifics, as there may be further developments. But more broadly, you do feel that what has happened, and whether it was the BCA's intention or not. What has happened is that people will be scared to write about science and about alternative complementary medicine in a robust manner.
I think British libel laws. I mean, one is just the sheer expense of this. I'm in a very fortunate position that I'm an experienced journalist with a long history and a bank account that can get me this far. But if I wasn't in that position, I would almost have been forced to buckle very early on. So I think there are libel issues that go beyond just this particular case. I think you're right on that.
Yeah, and increasingly, I mean, you've mentioned a couple of blogs there, and bloggers are very, very active and engaged with this particular story. And so, I mean, it's one thing for a journalist to worry about this and maybe have the backing of a news organisation or have reasonable experience knowing what they're writing. But for bloggers, there must be a huge fear as well.
Yes, and we're talking about crossing international boundaries here as well, because if you've written a blog in Australia and it gets read here in Britain, my understanding is that you could end up in a British libel court.
So, that's correct, yes.
Our laws really do affect people globally.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's probably about as much as we can say about the case, isn't it? So let's go on and talk about the book, the new book, which came out in paperback yesterday, coincidentally the same day as this happened. Trick or Treatment, Alternative Medicine on Trial. So
it's a hell of a subtitle, isn't it? Alternative Medicine on Trial. Who'd have thought it a year ago?
First of all, the book has quite an unusual dedicatee. So tell us about
that. Yes, God, I'd forgotten about that completely. But we dedicated it to His Royal Highness, the Prince of Wales, Prince Charles. And the reason was that he's been very vocal in issues relating to alternative therapies, complementary therapies, integrated medicine, call it what you will. But essentially, I sort of define this as being remedies and therapies that are biologically often implausible and which are generally outside mainstream medicine. So we might be talking about homeopathy or Reiki or Hopi ear candling, all of these things. And I think it was in 2000, I'm a bit fuzzy on the dates, but the Prince of Wales said, look, we need to find more evidence for this. We need to look at this stuff. And I think his implication was show that it works and then it'll be more widely adopted. So because of that call for research, we decided to write a book. I should explain that my co-author, Professor Edzard Ernst, is the world's first professor of complementary medicine based at Exeter Peninsula Medical School. And he spent the last 15 years looking at the research, conducting some research, but also looking at all of the other research. People often think that alternative medicine hasn't been well researched, but homeopathy has over 200 clinical trials, acupuncture even more. And so our task was, okay, Your Royal Highness, let's look at the evidence. You clearly want to know what it says, and we'll present you with the evidence. And that's why we dedicated the book to him. I think since the book has come out, I'm not sure he's read it. And if he's read it, I'm not sure he's understood it, because, you know, he's brought out Dutch originals, herbal medicines and detox, and continues to sort of seem to promote things which, as far as we're concerned, you know, in the book, I should stress, there are some alternative therapies that we endorse because the evidence backs them up. Things like irritable bowel syndrome, there's good evidence that hypnotherapy will help with that. Things like meditation are good for reducing anxiety and general well-being and relaxation and so on. But where the evidence doesn't back up a therapy, or where the risks are substantial, or where the costs are, that's when we just have to explain what the state of play is. And unfortunately, there hasn't been much of a shift in the way these therapies continue to be sold on the high street, marketed on street corners, marketed on the internet as well, and so on.
Well, as I said at the top of the show, and we often mention, you know, the idea of the scientific method as one of the things that this show likes. You start off the book. The first chapter of the book is basically a history of the scientific method and evidence-based medicine. So perhaps we should, you know, although we say it week in, week out, perhaps we should actually talk about what that means.
Yes, well, I think for hundreds of years, doctors would come up with potions, remedies, they'd bleed patients, they'd do all sorts of things based on really no evidence at all, based on their personal experience, based on what the ancient Greeks had done. And there was no medical science as we would understand it today, no real understanding of anatomy, no real understanding of what mercury did to the body, although it would be administered quite readily. No understanding really of what bloodletting would do. The idea with bloodletting was that poisonous things would stagnate in the blood, and by releasing blood, you could release the poison. And doctors would have patients that were thrashing about feverishly. They would remove blood, and the patient would seem to improve. Now, there was really just a sedative effect from removing so much blood. In the long term, it probably wasn't doing the patient any good at all. And in fact, we now know that those blood letters were probably doing more harm than good. Now, why do we know that now? Well, it goes back to a guy called James Lind. James Lind was a Scottish doctor, really a kind of a son of the Enlightenment, I think born and brought up in Edinburgh, but went to sea as a naval surgeon. And the big concern then was scurvy. Thousands of sailors around the world dying of scurvy, far more than were drowning at sea or were being killed in battle. But nobody knew what was causing scurvy, and nobody knew what the cure was. And people would try sulfuric acid and vinegar and beer and cider and seawater. And everybody had their own pet cure, and they kind of convinced themselves that it would work because they'd remember the successes and they'd forget the failures. And Lynn said, no, what we need to do is I'll get 12 sailors, all with the same level of scurvy, all in the same part of the ship. I'll give them hammocks in the same part of the ship. I'll give them the same diet, but I'll supplement the diet differently for each pair of sailors. So one pair would get the sulfuric acid, one pair would get the seawater, one pair would get the cider, one pair would get lemon juice. That's it. We'll try lemon juice for one pair. And within a week, all of the sailors were still terribly ridden with scurvy, except the pair that had had lemon juice. Now, Lind had no idea that it was vitamin C that was curing the patients. He had no idea about vitamins or anything like that. But at least he knew that lemon juice was the cure. And the reason he knew that was because he conducted this clinical, controlled clinical trial. And it took time to catch on, but in due course there were controlled trials on bloodletting, and since then everything else you can imagine. And this last century, I think, is maybe even only in the last 50 years, has medicine really begun to test its remedies ruthlessly and rigorously. Because the last thing you want to do is to give a remedy that's ineffective or perhaps dangerous, or perhaps not as good as another remedy that another doctor may be using.
Before we go on to look at the sort of the method used in the book in investigating some of the treatments, anybody that's involved in any sort of aspect of looking at alternative medicine will have heard the argument made by the proponents that this sort of testing, you know, double-blind testing, is in some way singularly unsuitable for that type of thing. I mean, how do you respond to that idea?
I think there's always a way of designing some kind of trial of some sort. So, for example, acupuncture is one. So you mentioned blinding there. Well, let's take it in two stages. With homeopathy, what you do is you give 100 patients a homeopathic pill. They're all suffering from migraine. And you have another 100 patients who are also suffering migraine, but you don't give them the homeopathic pill. Now, if you conduct your trial like that, the homeopathic group will almost certainly do better, because the act of taking a pill will psychologically benefit them. It may kick in some other aspects of their personality, the attention they'll get by having the pill given to them, the branding of the pill, the fact that the way it's given to them, all those things will have an effect. So if that group does better, is it the pill itself, or is it all of the psychology and the wrapping and the ritual surrounding it? So what you then have to do is give one group the homeopathic pill and give the other group a sugar pill, something that looks like the homeopathic pill, and you don't tell anybody who's got what. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's a pretty damn good test of homeopathy. And I see no reason why it shouldn't be a valid test. And indeed, there have been hundreds of such tests. Now, one of the problems that homeopaths will argue is that homeopathy is a highly individualized treatment. And they're absolutely right. If you go and see a homeopath, they will talk to you about your, you know, the color of your bathroom, the state of mind of your mother, everything that they will inquire about. And based on that, they will give you your remedy. Therefore, homeopaths will argue that you can't have these kind of big trials, but you can. And they've been conducted. What you do is you give 100 people an interview, and each one gets a different homeopathic remedy. And they walk out of the door and they collect it on the left as they go out. The other 100, you give them very detailed one-to-one interviews, and you give them a remedy, highly individualized, as far as they know, except it's not. They all end up with a sugar pill. So that way, you can even take into consideration the individualized nature of homeopathy and incorporate that within the trial. And the results are just not at all encouraging for homeopathy. Then homeopaths will say, but it works for my pet, works for my dog. My dog doesn't know about the placebo effect. Therefore, it must be valid. Or it works for babies. They don't know about the placebo effect. Now, scientists have to be open-minded about this. You hear these stories. When you hear anecdotes aren't evidence, but they're a good starting point for beginning to explore something more seriously. So you do the same thing with cattle. You give 100 cattle. One of the trials involved had diarrhea, cattle with diarrhea. The other group had diarrhea. They don't get homeopathy. They just get a different pill. and there's no significant difference between the two. So I think, and if we just move on to acupuncture, because acupuncture is a tricky one. Mm-hmm. People say, what can you do as a placebo treatment for acupuncture? Well, there are three possibilities.
So how do you somehow replicate having a needle stuck in
the exactly. skin? Exactly. You give the one group, you give them, maybe they've all got migraine, give them real acupuncture, which means you insert the needles to a very particular depth at very particular points on the body, and you see how they get on. With the other 100 patients, what do you do with them? How do you make them believe that they're getting acupuncture when they're not? Now, sugar pill's not going to work. What you can do is you can insert the needles, insert them in the wrong places. According to Chinese philosophy, that should do no good at all. Mm-hmm. Or you insert the needles superficially. So they just go, instead of going a centimetre into the body or several millimetres, they just go 1 millimetre in. That means they won't tap into the meridians, they won't affect the supposed qi in the body. That's a good placebo. If people are unhappy with that, then a device was invented by Edzard's team and actually another group in parallel. It's a lovely device. It's an acupuncture needle that collapses like a stage dagger. So you put it on the skin, and there's a guide tube as well, which acupuncturists will use. And you use the guide tube, you put the needle in, you tap it. It looks like the needle has gone into your skin, but it hasn't. You feel a little bit of pain, you feel a little bit of pressure, but the only thing holding up the needle is now the guide tube. And so therefore, you don't even have any penetration of the skin. And that's probably the best placebo. And there have been trials involving acupuncture needles that collapse like this. I should say that in acupuncture, the evidence is not wholly negative. For pain and nausea, the evidence is kind of borderline positive. I'm not convinced personally. I think the evidence is open to interpretation. In the book, we're not convinced, particularly because as more data is collected, the better the trials, the more recent the trials, the effects seem to diminish. And that's often what happens, that you initially conduct a trial, you get a big effect, you get very excited, other people replicate it more carefully with a bigger group, the effect goes away.
Presumably as well, there's a difference between acupuncture in terms of the meridians of the body and the particular places to put them in, and just sticking needles into somebody, randomly. I mean, presumably you can probably demonstrate an effect that somehow that has an effect, but the actual positioning is irrelevant.
I think there's very good data now, and I think a lot of what I call medical acupuncturists, i.e. those that don't necessarily work within the Chinese tradition, a lot of medical acupuncturists will acknowledge really that the position of the needle doesn't really matter very much. So if you conduct the trial where 100 patients have needles in very specific places based on ancient texts and so on, and another 100 patients where you're basically sticking needles wherever the fancy takes you, the improvement you get in both groups is pretty much the same. So there's something about sticking needles in people that changes their perception of pain, mm-hmm. or makes them less nauseous. Now, how are we tapping into the body? Is it to do with tapping into blocking gates in the neural network of the body, or is it the ritual of the process whereby patients are forgetting their pain for a while or overriding it in some other way?
There's an element which ties in with the idea of how can you properly trial these things. Where the other argument you often come up with when people are talking about homeopathy or whatever is, it works for me. And I've always wondered, is there a difference between the effect of these things on people who believe in it and people who don't believe in it?
I should think there is, because the placebo effect is a very messy and complicated and poorly understood phenomenon, but part of it is your belief system in what you're taking. Mm-hmm. And this is something that Ben Goldacre has written about extensively, about branding, for example. Branding, we take two pills, one's in a fancy packet and it costs twice as much as another, but chemically they're identical. Mm-hmm. The fancy, expensive branded one actually seems to have a bigger effect, because as well as the biochemical impact, you get a bigger placebo bonus with the branded one. So the belief system is important. But if you don't believe in branding, and in fact if you're antagonistic towards branding, may even have a negative nocebo effect, as it's called.
Nocebo, that's nice.
Yes, yeah. No, it's so Yeah, no, you're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about, I mean, we've just talked about a couple of the, you know, the couple of the treatments, homeopathy and acupuncture, and perhaps we've also already mentioned some of the conclusions that you've come to. But let's talk about the method, the sort of meta-analysis that you did. How did you go about, what did you and Professor Rans, how did you go about investigating the various treatments?
The idea was to look at the research that's been done already. Mm-hmm. So we didn't conduct any new research in the writing of the book, which probably... over the last 3 years, you know, we haven't, you know, we were always open to new research that was being published along the way, but as I said, we didn't say this is our data, and that's sort of important because it's partly based on Edzard's own research, but mm-hmm. it includes many other people's research. So we're not saying this is what we believe, we're not saying this is what we've researched, we're saying this is research based on hundreds of trials conducted on tens of thousands of patients around the world. And what you do is, well, you might look at somebody else's meta-analysis, for example, or systematic review. Now, what that means is that somebody has said, right, I'm going to look at whether homeopathy is effective for hay fever. And what they'll do is they'll look at all of the trials conducted involving homeopathy and hay fever. And what they'll then do is they'll say, right, I'm going to have some criteria as to particularly in terms of the quality of the study, because there's no point including in your systematic review or meta-analysis, there's no point conducting badly conducted studies, because a misleading result is worse than no result at all. So you have a certain threshold of quality, and once you apply that threshold, you may demand that there's blinding in the trial, that patients don't know what they're getting, that there are good controls, that there's randomization, that you didn't have all the male patients in one group and female patients in another, they were randomly allocated. And once you've applied your cuts, you then have a pool of trial data, and you then look at what that mass of data in general says. You don't look at one particular trial, you look at what the generality of the data says, and you can apply mathematical approach to that, which is heading towards a meta-analysis, or you can be a bit less mathematical about it, and that would be more of a general systematic review that you'd be conducting at that point.
So you've already mentioned that the vast majority of the treatments, without wanting to give away the ending of the book, the vast majority of treatments are pretty much ineffective. I mean, what do you think? Where do we go from here in terms of?
I think the ineffective is one issue. Which are effective mm-hmm. and which are ineffective? If I'm a parent or if I'm interested in my own health, what should I use and what shouldn't mm-hmm. I use? And the shouldn't I use is not just a case of it being ineffective, but is it possibly dangerous? So we talked about acupuncture. Acupuncture, as far as I'm concerned, the evidence is borderline, it's really marginal. But what are the side effects of acupuncture? Well, about 10% of patients get minor bleeding, a bit of bruising, localized pain. More anxious patients may experience dizziness or even fainting. Is that really worthwhile when the benefits are so poorly understood? If we look at hay fever, where many high street acupuncturists will claim to treat hay fever, there's no good evidence to back that up. In that case, the balance is very much on the negative side, that the side effects outweigh it. So I think if people are interested, then I think the book is worth reading. You can borrow it from a library. You can read a lot of what we've said online in terms of articles we've written as well. So people don't need to get the book. They just need to know what our conclusions are, I think. And the reason for writing the book, I think, is that the misinformation out there is enormous in terms of, for example, you can buy homeopathy at Boots. Now, that will give people the impression that if it's in a high street pharmacist, it must be effective. Now, we explain in the book that there's no good evidence for any condition whatsoever that homeopathy is effective. So don't necessarily think that just because it's in the high street in a big pharmaceutical company that it works. If you see stuff on the internet, again, we know that there's lots of claims on the internet that are unsubstantiated. The supplements, celebrities often will endorse these therapies and say how wonderful they are. Sports people will do. And often people will think, well, if such and such Olympic sports person uses Reiki, it must be effective because they care about their body, they've got the best advice there is. I think the truth is that they've got so much money to splash on their health and well-being, their sports people, that they can afford the the pampering and some of the flakier stuff. But if you've got a limited budget, then it's important to know that, again, there's no good evidence, for instance, for Reiki. It's a lovely, lovely demonstration done by a researcher called Emily Rosa. She tested something very closely related to Reiki. The idea of Reiki is that there's an energy, a universal energy, and Reiki healers will tap into that energy and drain it from the body or channel it into the body. And Emily Rosa did an experiment with people that sort of believe this. And she said, look, put your hands through this curtain, both hands through the curtain. I'll put my hand under one of them, and you tell me where my hand is. Is it under your left hand or your right hand? You claim you can sense the energy. You tell me, is my hand under your left or your right? And they all said, yes, we can do that. We'll do that easily. I think she did 280 tests, and pretty much bang on half of them could get it right, half the time, which is what random chance would guess. And Emily Rosa had this published, and the extraordinary thing is, the sting in the tail is that she was 11 years old, 12 years old. She's the youngest person ever to have had a paper published in a medical journal. And it just shows, if a 12-year-old can point this out, why are we often fooled into believing these things work?
That's a brilliant point to end on. Simon, thanks very much for joining us again. I've just got I just want to make a quick announcement before we finish. The wonderful organisation Skeptics in the Pub is expanding to another city next week. Next Tuesday, the 12th of May at 6:30 is the first Oxford Skeptics in the Pub at the Chequers in High Street, where you can see a talk given by the dashing Dr. Ben Goldacre. And incidentally, if you go along and you enjoy that, next month you'll be able to see a certain Mr. Simon Singh speaking there as well.
Yes. So. And I'll be in Edinburgh at Skeptics in the Pub on the 14th of May. And Ed Sard will be back in London, I think, on the 20th of May. So we all love Skeptics in the Pub.
Absolutely.
You've been listening to Little Atoms with Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, and our guest Simon Singh. And we'll be back next week.